Chapter 42 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 42. I slept like a log, in spite of plank bed and no mattress, being worn out, and was wakened by the ringing of the prison bell at 5:30. I got up and dressed, putting on the ghastly prison clothes which had been served out to me the night before. I began to have a reaction, and to feel frightened and wretched. What if there was some hitch about my sureties, and I could not get out? My imagination began to work fantastically, suggesting that the whole thing was a trap, and that once in this prison, a mere number without a name, I was done for, and would be kept indefinitely. The door was unlocked and left open. I heard the clanking of tins and pails. Two prisoners came along with a sort of tank on wheels and told me to empty my slops. A warder looked in and said something which I did not understand. The door was shut and locked. Then there was a long pause. I remained apathetically sitting on the little backless stool which was all there was in the way of a chair. Uneatable and evil-smelling food was handed in. I looked at it with disgust and put it as far away from me as possible. It was nearly dark. The only window, a small square, was so high up that I could reach it only by standing on my stool. I was faint with hunger, and as I had had nothing to eat since breakfast the day before. I had been too agitated to eat my good lunch at the Old Bailey, cold chicken and bread, and owing to the fact that I had expected to get out before dinner time, I had not bothered about food. The bread and cocoa which had been offered me when I got into the reception room I had not touched. The door was again opened, and my untasted breakfast was removed by a prisoner who eagerly took possession of my bread and stuffed it into his shirt. I sat on for some time in a dazed condition, hearing the noise of walking and tramping outside. Then a fierce-looking officer looked in and shouted angrily at me, "What are you doing here? Why haven't you made your bed? What do you think you are doing? You ought to be in the shed." I looked at him with wide eyes and then burst into tears. I buried my face in my hands and sobbed. He came up to me in the kindest way and put his arm round my neck. "Here, sonny, this won't do. Cheer up. No harm meant. I know it must be very hard on you, first day and all. You needn't go into the shed if you'd rather stay here." His kindness made me cry all the more, and he tactfully went away and came back 10 minutes later, and asked me how I felt. I said I felt all right now, and would like to go to the shed, though I had no idea what the shed was. He showed me how to fold my blankets and lean my plank bed against the wall. He got a wet towel and wiped my face and dried it, making jokes all the time. May God reward him. He then conducted me down 2 flights of iron stairs and out of the dreadful hall into the open air, and so to the shed, a large building where about 100 prisoners were working at sewing sacks and picking oakum. I was given some oakum to pick. Either before or after that, I forget which, I had an hour's exercise, walking round and round a yard with 150 or so of other prisoners. Then came more revolting food in my cell, the mere sight and smell of it making me sick. 10 years later I starved on it for 7 weeks, losing nearly 2 stone of weight in the process. But at this time I merely looked at it and hoped someone would take it away soon. The editor of the Tablet, among others, declares, in contradiction to me, that the food in prisons is really excellent. Of course, never having been in prison, he is bound to know more about it than I do. Perhaps the editor of the Tablet likes lumps of stinking meat swimming in lukewarm kitchen grease. There is no accounting for taste. Personally, I do not fancy it, and when the time came I preferred, even starving as I was, not to eat it, and to live for 7 weeks on crusts of bread and watery cocoa. After dinner, we went back to the shed, and I picked more oakum. By this time I was in complete despair. I could not understand why my sureties had not come to take me out, and I made up my mind that something had gone wrong, and that I was going to be kept in prison. Of course, this was childish and unreasonable on my part, but in prison, especially at first, one is not reasonable, and is liable to all sorts of panics and nightmarish ideas. I sat in the shed for about 2 hours, and at last I heard my number called out. Curiously, I forget the number. I jumped to my feet and went up to the officer who had just come into the shed and called my number. He said, "You are wanted by the governor. Come along with me." I said, "Is it my sureties?" He said, "I don't know anything about it. All I know is you are to go to the governor." I followed him into one of the rooms leading into the reception office, where I had been the night before. My heart leapt up, for there was the governor talking affably to dear old Sholto and my clerical friend and benefactor, who both smiled and shook hands with me. I was immediately taken into the reception room and relieved of my prison clothes, my own clothes, watch and money being given back to me. The only thing I had been allowed to keep was my rosary, which I was wearing round my neck. When I was clothed and in my right mind, I went back into the other room, and the governor shook hands and said, "Well, goodbye, don't come back again," and I went off with my two sureties. Sholto had to rush off somewhere, but Mr. Mills carried me off to a restaurant and fed me sumptuously. Curiously enough, I could hardly eat anything. On my way home to my mother's, she was then staying at Cliveden Place, I thought to myself, "I cannot risk going back to that hellish place." I made up my mind that I would come to terms with Ross, which of course would have been easy enough to do provided I would climb down and withdraw my charges. This state of mind, which had been produced by one night and day in a real convict prison, as distinct from Brixton, a remand prison, where you keep your own clothes and can order in any food that you like to pay for, was of course exactly the state of mind which Sir George Lewis, on behalf of Ross, had wanted to produce in me. If I had been let out the day before, as the recorder fully intended I should be, I would not have been able to imagine how dreadful it is to be in prison as a convicted prisoner. I had thought it bad enough in Brixton, but Brixton was heaven compared with Wormwood Scrubs. However, one night's good sleep in a real bed, in a comfortable bedroom, followed by bacon and eggs and toast and marmalade for breakfast, altered all my feelings. I swore to myself that I would spend the rest of my life in an underground dungeon before I climbed down an inch to Ross and Lewis. I spent a few days without profit with a solicitor who was not really fitted to cope with my case, and then good luck, or rather, for there is no such thing as luck, Providence sent me to Carter and Bell, that is to say, Mr. Edward Bell, for Carter is non-existent, and at last I had a solicitor who believed in me and approved of my methods. Mr. Edward Bell is a Scotsman, and his great-grandfather was hanged for being out in the 45 Jacobite Rising. He therefore has fighting blood and spirit of his own, and appreciation of the Douglas fighting blood and spirit in me. Leaving out the Chancery business, which had become hopelessly compromised before he came on the scene at all, Mr. Bell and I together never lost a case. We smashed Lewis and Lewis, with the able assistance of Mr. Cummins Carr, now KC, but then a junior, on two stricken fields, and even in my action against the Morning Post, where Mr. Cummins Carr let me down rather badly, as I think, we won the case, though I did not get the damages to which I was entitled. Then began the, at first apparently hopeless, task of trying to get evidence against Ross. I saw Mr. Cummins Carr and made a statement to him. He said to me, "If you will undertake to go into the witness box and say there what you have told me, I will draw up a plea of justification. But I tell you frankly that unless you can get quite a lot of real evidence, apart from your own, you will not have a chance." I got most of the evidence myself at the very last moment, as I have already stated. I tried clue after clue, and came up against blanks and brick walls, and people who were not going to be mixed up in the affair. At last I got word, sent anonymously, that there was a certain Mr. E, living at some number in a street near Camden Hill. I will not give his name, for obvious reasons. Who was the respectable father of a young boy who had been a victim of Ross. When I got this information, there were less than 10 days to run before my trial was due to begin, and I had no evidence at all, though I had been to Guernsey in one fruitless quest, and to a dozen other places in vain. I went to the address given and asked for Mr. E. No such name was known there. My heart sank into my boots. I turned away and looked down the street of at least 150 houses. What was I to do? I prayed desperately to St. Anthony of Padua, for whom I have always had a special cult. I walked a few yards with my eyes on the ground. A voice said, "What do you want? Can I help you?" I looked up and saw a beautiful little boy about 10 years old, smiling at me. I said, "I was looking for someone at a number which was given me in this street, and now I am told there is no such name known there." He said, "Tell me the name and the number." I did so. He said, "All right, I know where it is. The numbers in the street have been changed." He took my hand and led me right down to the other end of the street, stopped in front of a door and said, "You'll get what you want here." I let go his hand and went up to the door and rang the bell. I looked round and the little boy was gone. I looked down the street both ways and saw no sign of him. The door opened and I said, "Does Mr. E live here?" "Yes, he does. Will you come in?" was the reply. With great difficulty I got from Mr. E confirmation of what I had been told. The difficulty was caused by the woman who had let me in, and who, I found, was his second wife and stepmother of his two sons. She said, "Don't tell him anything. We don't want to have any scandal in the family." I appealed strongly to Mr. E. I said, "If you don't help me, I shall be sent to prison. For God's sake, tell me." He said, "Very well, I can't refuse. The boy himself is dead. After what happened when he left home, he went to South Africa and died there. His elder brother, who is a private in the blank regiment, now at Goring, will tell you the whole story." He gave me the name and military address of the brother, and I went out. This is the story to which I have referred as being what I believe to be a supernatural experience. It did not strike me till long afterwards, when I got the evidence which proved to be perhaps the most damning of all the evidence I got against Ross, that the whole thing was mysterious and wonderful. How should a little boy of 10 years old know about the change of numbers and where Mr. E lived? Why should a child of that age go up to a man he had never seen before and say, "What do you want? Can I help you?" I firmly believe that the child was an angel, or, at any rate, that he was supernaturally moved to help me. He was a most beautiful little boy, and he had an angelic face and smile. And how did he disappear in the space of time, a few seconds, between when I let go of his hand and when I looked round again? Perhaps Dr. Barnes or Dean Inge will oblige with an explanation which will satisfy believers in the Darwinian hypothesis and the impossibility of miracles. Even after this, I had a desperate difficulty in getting the evidence. When I got to Goring, I was told that the particular unit in which the man I wanted was serving had been transferred to a town in Norfolk. I went there and went to the headquarters of the colonel of the regiment. It was a house belonging to a man I knew, Charlie Tracy, now Lord Sudley, but he was not there himself. The colonel was odious. When he heard what I wanted, he was insolent and rude, and declared that he would not let me see the man I wanted. I had to have a regular fight with him. In the presence of his adjutant and several other officers, I told him that unless he produced the man, for whom I had a subpoena, I would apply to the judge for a bench warrant, and that I would publicly expose him as a man who was trying to shield Ross and what he stood for. He grew red in the face and stormed out of the room, followed by his officers. The door was slammed, and I was left alone. After about 5 minutes, a very charming young subaltern, very much a gentleman, which was not always the case in those days of temporary gentlemen, came in and told me that the colonel had sent him to say that he had sent for the man, and that I might interview him in his, the subaltern's, presence. A few minutes later, the young man arrived. The subaltern told him what I wanted, and said, "You are not obliged to answer Lord Alfred's questions unless you wish." The man was reluctant at first, but I appealed to him and said, "You don't want to shield the man who ruined your brother, and is, indirectly, responsible for his death, do you?" I also told him that unless he told me the truth, I would be sent to prison for denouncing Ross. He thereupon gave me the whole story, which was damning for Ross. I wrote down what he said, and he read it through and signed it, after being told by the subaltern that he need not do so unless he wished. I gave him a subpoena and £3, and told him he would have to be at the Old Bailey on the date fixed for my trial, early in December. This was a great triumph, and bucked me up considerably. It never rains, but it pours. After that, evidence began to flow in. I got the names of half a dozen people who could give me valuable information from a man I went to see at Yarmouth. In the end, I had 13 or 14 witnesses. They were all respectable people. One was a clergyman of the Church of England, and I had not one single case of what is called tainted evidence. The only one I had who was of that kind was the man I saw at Yarmouth, and he failed to turn up at the trial. When his name was called, he did not answer. Subsequently, my solicitor, Mr. Edward Bell, traced him to one of the London hospitals, where he was informed that the man had been brought in, unconscious and suffering from a narcotic poison. Whoever was responsible for getting him in this condition did me a very good turn, for he was the only witness I had who might have been severely damaged in cross-examination by Sir Ernest Wilde, Ross's counsel, now Recorder of London. A dramatic scene occurred at the trial when the young soldier, whose evidence I had such difficulty in getting, gave his evidence. He told the story of how his brother, then a boy of 16, disappeared from home, and how he and his father obtained information that Ross was responsible. He described how he went to a bar in Copthall Avenue, which Ross frequented, and, seeing Ross, said to him, "What have you done with my brother?" He said that Ross thereupon offered him money, which he refused, and then started blustering, and threatened to send for the police, and give him in charge for blackmail. Finally, he said, he was frightened and went away. His brother shortly afterwards went to South Africa, but he did not know where he got the money to go. He died there. At this point, the poor fellow was overcome with emotion. Mr. Cummins Carr said to him, "Would you recognise the man you saw in the bar in Copthall Avenue if you saw him?" He replied, "I don't know whether I would. It is several years ago." "Well," said Carr, "look round the court and see if you can see him." Amid breathless silence, the witness looked first of all up at the public gallery, and then all round the body of the court. Finally, he cast his eyes down to the solicitor's table, where Ross sat next to George Lewis, facing him. He said, "There is a gentleman sitting at the table who bears a striking resemblance to the man I saw in the bar in Copthall Avenue." "Will Mr. Ross stand up?" said the judge, Mr. Justice Coleridge. Ross stood up. "That is the man," said the witness. Will it be believed that this intensely dramatic scene was absolutely unreported in all the papers? I have already described what happened after the trial, and how the extraordinary testimonial to Ross was got up and signed by 350 prominent people, including the then Prime Minister and his wife. I have never been able to arrive at any satisfactory explanation of this astounding occurrence. Perhaps Dr. Barnes and Dean Inge, who presumably do not believe in the devil, might be able to suggest a reasonable solution. I confess that it beats me entirely. One of the signatories to the Ross testimonial was, by the way, Dr. Barnes's predecessor as Bishop of Birmingham, Dr. Wakefield. End of chapter 42.